When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering the new name for Kingston's Museum of Healthcare.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
The Museum of Healthcare is entering a new chapter, announcing it will now be known as the Canadian Museum of Healthcare, a name change that reflects the museum's growth and an expanding vision for its future. Located in the Ann Bailey Building on the Kingston General Hospital site, the museum explores the history of healthcare from the 18th century to the modern era. While rooted in Kingston, its exhibits already tell stories from across the country, highlighting key developments in national medical history. Anna Collette, Programming and Communications Coordinator with the Canadian Museum of Healthcare, spoke to the decision to change the name.
This has been a long time coming because our collection is actually quite national. We have over 35,000 artifacts in our collection, and it's the largest collection of medical artifacts in Canada. So we thought it was a great time to, with the new year, to start aligning ourselves with our collection and our actual outreach.
Colette says visitors shouldn't expect a dramatic shift in the museum's direction. The gallery already features artifacts and stories from across Canada, tracing the progress of healthcare nationally, also making the new name a more accurate reflection of what the museum already offers. Colette shared some of the museum's current offerings.
So with our national collection, we can certainly reach within our own collection as well. One example I can think of is a pair of dentures that was made by a man in British Columbia, and he didn't want to pay for his dentures, so he actually went and shot a deer and filed down the teeth to make a pair of deer teeth dentures. That's another interesting artifact we have that's from British Columbia. One exhibit we have focuses on vaccination and immunization, so it takes quite a large scope because it looks at cases of different diseases like polio, diphtheria, and smallpox, and how that has changed since vaccination programs have been introduced. So it takes quite a large scope, and we have an artifact called the Iron Lung, which was built in Toronto, and it's quite the star artifact at the museum. It was used for children who had polio who couldn't breathe on their own. It's from the 1930s before a vaccination was introduced, so it really shows a time before vaccines.
Looking ahead, the Canadian Museum of Healthcare will continue the work it has always done, all while embracing new opportunities to tell an even broader range of stories from Canada's healthcare past.
So we're hoping it brings a bit more attention to healthcare history and also our role in Kingston and reaching even further to national scope. So starting in Kingston, we've always been deeply rooted in Kingston, but hoping to branch out a little bit. The Canadian Museum of Healthcare is open Wednesday to Friday, 10 to 4 during the winter. And starting in June, we're open every day from 10 to 4. And students with their IDs, admission is $5.
For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, that covers TLTI's $196,000 casino payout.
Thank you, Jesse. A third quarter casino revenue payment will deliver nearly $197,000 to each of Gananoque and the Township of Leeds in the Thousand Islands, providing a welcome but increasingly scrutinized source of municipal funding as local casino revenues continue to decline from past highs. The Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation announced it is issuing a $196,783 payment to each municipality for the period from October 1st to December 31st, tied to the operation of Shorelights Casino Thousand Islands. So far in OLG's 2025-26 fiscal year running April 1st to March 31st, Gananoque and TLTI have each received $688,188. Since the casino opened in June 2022, cumulative payments to each community now total over $34 million. The payments are made under OLG's Municipality Contribution Agreement, which applies a standardized province-wide formula based on a graduated scale of gaming revenue generated at each land-based casino site. While the latest payment reinforces the long-standing financial relationship between the casino and its host municipalities, it also comes amidst a clear downward trend in annual casino revenue flowing to Gananoque and TLTI. In the 2024-25 fiscal year, both municipalities received roughly $938,000 each from Shorelines Casino Thousand Islands, representing an approximately 18% drop, or more than $200,000 compared to the previous year. The decline is part of a longer-term pattern that has seen payments fall from more than $1.8 million annually in the early 2010s to current levels. Province-wide host communities have received nearly $2.4 billion in non-tax gaming revenue since 1994. OLG says it remains committed to reinvesting 100% of its profits back into Ontario communities with casino operations supporting economic development, infrastructure, investment, and job creation. Over the past 9 years, gaming service providers have invested more than $2.9 billion in private sector capital across Ontario, leading to the opening of 7 new casinos, 2 large-scale resorts, developments and expansions, and numerous gaming floor and non-gaming and amenity upgrades. For Gananoque and TLTI, however, the latest quarterly payment underscores a financial reality that is increasingly shaping budget discussions. While casino revenue remains valuable, it can no longer be relied upon as the steady growing source of funding it once was. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about a new workshop series for young entrepreneurs in Kingston.
Thank you, Dinah. The Kingston Economic Development Corporation has partnered with their counterparts in London, Ontario, to give local aspiring food entrepreneurs access to a workshop series tailored to starting and expanding food manufacturing and packaging businesses. The Foodpreneur Advantage program is a 6-part virtual workshop that is designed with the unique challenges of starting and maintaining a food manufacturing business in mind. The program continues to be run by London's Small Business Enterprise Center, with Kingston participants tuning into sessions that kicked off earlier in the month, running each Thursday morning on a weekly basis until mid-February. Business Development Manager of Small and Medium Enterprises, Rob Tamblin, said starting a more accessible Kingston-based program to learn about consumer packaged goods was considered following consultations during COVID, but ultimately the existing program in London made sense to join on to. With Kingston believed to have one of the higher numbers of restaurants per capita in Ontario, Tamblin says it makes sense for there to be a local interest in a less localized revenue stream. With the first session kicking off on Thursday, January 15th, Tamblin said 17 people or businesses in the Kingston area had registered for this initial workshop. Subsequent one-hour sessions will continue weekly until February 19th, exploring topics including food safety, packaging and labeling, and marketing food products. Info on specific sessions and how to register can be found on the Development Corporation's website.
And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about a boundary review in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Loyalist Township Council voted 4-3 to table further discussion until 2027 on a ward boundary review. This decision came after the Ontario Land Tribunal repealed a previous ward reconfiguration bylaw from May of 2025. At that time, Council passed a bylaw to establish a new ward boundary configuration. A notice of appeal was filed with the Ontario Land Tribunal in October of 2025, and on December 18th, the Tribunal issued an order that repealed that bylaw. This means there are no changes to the existing council composition and ward boundaries for the 2026 municipal election. At their latest meeting, staff originally recommended receiving the report and increasing the review budget by $40,000. Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend added an amendment that would see further discussion left until 2027. Townend spoke about the need for adding the amendment and why he supported it.
My intent with the amendment is it doesn't, you know, if we just take the motion as it stands today, you know, there's essentially nothing. We're agnostic about any future process. What this does is it ensures that whether the next council wants to do a ward boundary review or not, that it comes to that council for sure to be dealt with. It provides some degree of certainty for those who, you know, who might be upset with the fact that we are status quo for 2026. You know, this will be dealt with in the next term of council.
Councillor Jake Ennis opposed the amendment.
I'm not going to be supporting the amendment or the original motion. My view is that we should finish the ward review that we started, and we should finish it as soon as possible. We should not stop or cancel the ward review before it's finished. The ward review will be finished when a change to the status quo is passed and it is not appealed or it survives an appeal. That's when the ward review will be over. So essentially, if this amendment passes, it's going to shut down the debate a bit. The township's own, our own expert Watson consultants found that the status quo wards to be problematic and that they do not ensure effective representation. All citizens have the right to effective representation in government. This is a democratic right enshrined in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Ennis spoke about a previous option, which he still supports.
The OLT has taken one of the final options proposed by our Watson consultants, one of the final options for change off the table, but there was a second final option. And the OLT did also conclude that final option two was reasonable. So in my view, I would like to see, and it doesn't cost taxpayers any more money, that staff bring forward final option two to council for consideration for adoption at a future meeting. The need for change to the wards hasn't changed. The reasons we undertook the ward review haven't changed. If anything, it's become more imperative to finish the ward review and be clear with the public. We should finish the ward review that we started. We should not delay it to a future council, and we should finish it as soon as possible.
Councillor Lorna Willis pointed out the cost of the last appeal.
If there's an appeal, the last one costs $53,000. So any new decision could likely be appealed and could likely cost that $53,000 again or more.
Councillor Paul Proderick noted the money the township had already spent on the review.
Having been to all the town halls and numerous events, and I don't hear in the community right now anyways a big urge to move ahead with anything right now. And I'm looking at, if I read the report correctly, spent almost $125,000 on this, and I don't think at this time anything more than receiving the report is appropriate.
Mayor Jim Hagedorn spoke about the upcoming election and additional staffing costs.
Anything more than this during an election year, I think, is just going to be extremely confusing. It's going to muddy the waters. And I always like to see a healthy lineup of candidates. And I believe that the confusion alone may deter some from actually putting their name forward. I'm even more concerned that the electorate will have concerns and be confused during the election, because we're going to finish a review. We'll come up with a response or a bylaw. It may be amended, or sorry, it may be appealed. So just that significant confusion in the length of 10 months, I think is just, for one thing, I don't think it's fair to the electorate that they would have to figure out in October what they're actually voting on. The other thing is, you know, related to cost, staff are already going to be already are working on an election. Staff that are working on the election would be the ones that would be administering the review and bringing it back to council. So they can only work on one thing at a time. So in all reality, we probably would have to bring in an external source to be able to assist council through the remainder of this process. That is an additional cost. It's not in the budget. It would be over and above the budget that the taxpayers would be absorbing.
Council passed the motion with the amendment in a close 4-3 vote. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about adaptive mobility technology in Prince Edward County.
Electric vehicles of all types are on the market, and we see a variety of them scooting around town. The Community Care for Seniors Center in Picton hosted a webinar this past week that was presented by Lisa LaPierre from the Ontario Ministry of Transport in Kingston, featuring everything you need to know about e-scooters. Participants could watch in person at the center or watch from the comfort of their home online. I decided to go to the center to meet seniors and talk to them firsthand and learn details about e-scooters for my own interest. Bill and Isla were two people who came to the presentation, and both were more than happy to chat about electric vehicles as well as their thoughts about the future should they not be able to drive. Bill and Isla chat with me before the presentation. Bill, what brought you here today? Are you interested in e-scooters, or what brought you here today?
Just preparing for when I'm older, my dear, for mobility.
Meaning,
if I ever come to the age where I lose my driver's license, I want something to be able to get around.
And you think a scooter will do that?
A scooter or one of them cars that I see.
Yeah, right. That's good, Lisa.
Right. There's a number of different vehicles out
right,
there.
Right. Yeah.
That
exactly.
A lot of people are using.
Yeah.
How about you, Isla? What brought you here today?
The same as I am. Right now I'm still able to drive, but who knows how long something could happen. And I'm really more interested in the little cars, you know. I'd like to get up there and go in my little car.
Me as well.
I haven't seen too many around in Picton, have you?
No, just in Belleville. I've seen one or two in Picton.
I did too.
Yeah.
And I did see one. I was in the mall in Kingston with my daughter. And we passed a little store, and there was a little car sitting there. But she was kind of in a hurry, so I would have liked to stop and had a look in that little thing. But she was in a hurry, so.
And the chat, I sit in them. You know, I check them every time I go to Belleville.
How much do they cost?
Around $10,000 was the last figure I had seen.
Yeah, I think so.
But it includes everything.
So now will you be showing those today?
I don't know what they're showing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, and we can ask questions. We watched the presentation together where we learned about e-scooters and several other electric vehicles, the laws set by the Ontario Ministry of Transport, safety requirements, where they can be used, batteries, and what types of vehicles are not legal. Bill and Isla were interested in the low-speed small cars, so we were able to ask questions about those vehicles.
I think the people in the room were interested in the small cars. And I think you've made it clear that you don't have information about that because the ministry is working with that. Do you have any idea when there will be some information about these small cars?
No, the information that we have as of right now is that there are rules for those small devices, the small car devices. And it really comes down to the officers to enforce the law on them. So they do consult with us to know, because there's new stuff coming out every month. And so it's hard for officers often to determine if they are legal or not, and what's a mobility device and what's not. So it's up to them to enforce it. But those gray areas, really, like, we make policies and we do pilot projects and stuff like that, but we don't do the enforcement. What's important for the community to know is that if a senior is considering purchasing one of these, you need to go on our MTA website on low-speed vehicles and look at what the qualification of those are. And if you go to a person who's selling them and these things are not on the device, then they are not a legal device. And so please do not purchase them. If you have questions, you can always send me some questions and I can help, give you those details if you can't find them. But that's where it's really important, because a lot of people will sell these to seniors and then they'll leave the city very quickly because they don't want to have, because what's going to happen is the police is going to stop them, tell them they can't use it, then they're going to go back to this company and they don't want to have to do refunds, right? So they come in towns and they leave very quickly. So it's really important to protect ourselves and to make sure that they have the right requirements.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was interesting. At least we found out something.
That's right.
We'll
go out
and buy one when
we... No, we won't do that. When I'm too young yet anyway.
Oh, yes.
But I guess, you know what, it wouldn't matter what age you were, if something happened.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to prepare.
Yeah.
Although Bill and Isla were disappointed that the low-speed vehicles were not covered in the presentation, they were happy to come to the center and then join the bridge games afterwards. For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about junior hockey in Northumberland County.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones, reporting for CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. The owner of the Northumberland Stars junior hockey team operating out of Colburn says he wants to increase community outreach and engagement. Alex McConnell and business partner Bill Dyer purchased the team in April, leading the club to the top of the Greater Metro Junior Hockey League standings. McConnell says creating a stronger bond in Cramie Township will be beneficial to the team.
Northumberland Stars is a junior hockey team with players aged between 16 and 21. There's no import restrictions as well. So we've got players from Sweden, Russia, Belgium, the States, Canada, obviously, with a good group of local guys as well. It's exciting junior hockey with no restrictions, really.
And why Colburn?
Glenn Campbell had the team in Colburn now, before we purchased the team in April. But Colburn, I think, is a great spot where, you know, you get the small town junior hockey feel. It's a strong community, a lot of good local businesses and great people in the area. So I think, once we get the team established and have the community involved, I think that there's a lot of potential for it to be, you know, a big piece of Colburn for sure.
So then how does the GMHL differ from other junior hockey leagues in the area?
So, I mean, just with the kind of the closest local teams like the Port Hope Panthers, Colburn Cougars, or the Trenton Golden Hawks, they're restricted on the imports. So they're basically Canadian and American players. The junior C team in Port Hope, they're allowed the extra overage year with the 21-year-olds, which is similar to us. We're an unsanctioned league, so there's no connection to Hockey Canada. So basically, it's a open borders. There's no restrictions on the imports. There's a limit on the 21-year-olds. We're able to have two guys that have played the previous year, and then five new ones, which is up for potential debate, but that's how the rule is currently. And then 16-year-olds, you're allowed as many. There's no limit on that, so gives the young guys a good opportunity to get in and not be kind of handcuffed with only one spot or two spots available. We've had a couple good 16-year-olds over the last few years as well. So
how do you describe the play of your team?
The play of our team this season, I think we're definitely a skilled team, but we're very hardworking. It starts kind of from the top of our lineup down. We've got a lot of experienced guys with a lot of junior games that potentially going to be going and playing at college or university next year. But yeah, I'd say we're an exciting team. We're high scoring. We've been leading the league in goals for, leading the league in goals or in goals against as well. So it's tight defensively, but definitely a good offensive punch as well, which generally makes for an exciting game. But yes, it's a really good group of guys this year for sure.
So then, if I buy a ticket, so for my family and I, we buy tickets. What's the experience going to be like?
I think ticket prices are great. It's only $5, so it's we've kept it low, so it's cost affordable. We'd just like to kind of see the community out and get involved. But I think what you could expect coming out to a game would be, you know, a fast paced, exciting, probably high scoring game, and you know, obviously a Stars win as well.
I know that your organization presented to Cranby Council recently, and there was discussion about struggling to get sponsors. Are you attributing that to possible economic conditions in the community, outreach? What seems to be the issue there?
I think it would probably be exposure and just kind of community involvement. I don't think, you know, as a team, there's been a ton of community involvement in the last couple of seasons. So that's definitely something that we've focused on, working closely with Chris Kerwin at the Keeler Center and getting involved and trying to establish those connections and relationships within the community is definitely something that we'd love to do, something that we look forward to doing, and a goal of ours for sure. So we want to give back and do as much as we can locally, and hopefully, you know, in return, we'll see that reciprocated. But yeah, I mean, the guys, majority of the guys are billeting. We do have about probably 10 local guys as well. So everybody's right here. We've got half of the guys basically living right in Colborne as well. So, you know, they're excited and hoping to get involved, whether it's with minor hockey, this local schooling system. We were involved in the Santa Claus parade this year. Anything really to get out and get involved, the boys are happy to do it. And it's definitely a goal of ours for sure.
So then what do you see the future of the Northumberland Stars in Colborne and the community itself?
I think with the progression we've made this year and some of the relationships we've already built, I think we're definitely off to a great start. You know, I think being involved over the summer as well in just local fundraisers, maybe hosting some of our own like baseball tournaments, road hockey tournaments, that type of thing, just showing that, you know, we do want to give back, we do want to get involved. I think it's the potential in Colborne, obviously it's a small community, but I think it's a very tight-knit, good welcoming community as well. So I think, you know, once we get established and really show that we're for real and that we care and that we're putting a valuable product on the ice as well, and you know, they're more to just the team than the game as well, getting involved and helping with the youth and giving back to minor hockey and whatnot as well. I think there's a ton of potential, and it's what's kept us in Colborne for sure.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up on the corridor, supported by local realtor Kim Purcell at kimpurcell.ca, is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 29th, bitterly cold here in the city of Kingston, daytime high of minus 14. We'll actually feel a little closer to minus 12 in the sun, but we do have the possibility of some isolated flurries in the afternoon. Friday, January 30th, daytime high of minus 11, feeling closer to minus 20. More snow in the forecast, not a ton of accumulation, but we will have snow falling on the 30th of January. Saturday, January 31st, daytime high of minus 10, feeling closer to minus 12, otherwise it is sunny. And we get our first single-digit negative temperature day coming up on Sunday, February 1st, daytime high of minus 7, only going to feel like minus 9, practically balmy compared to everything that came before it. And then Monday, February 2nd, daytime high of minus 5, overnight low of minus 11, with a little bit of snow forecasted for the afternoon.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering. When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.